Holding on Zion and Bay's five lines from the bottom. We started discussing yesterday in connection with what we had about piece of time in, about the divisions and details of the Tzurah, whether they're Deraisa, Derabanan, Halacha Moshe Mitzvah. If not, we mentioned, Rabbi Yitzchak had mentioned the various details in Tanakh that are Halacha Moshe Mitzvah. One was, we said, Mikra Sofrim, the proper way of pronouncing the words, and another one was Itur Sofrim, the stylistic differences, like the various places where it says Achar.
Mikra Sofrim means what?
Mikra Sofrim literally means the way that Sofrim reads. So we said yesterday, one meaning of it is not that Sofrim made these things up. We're saying Halacha Moshe Mitzvah, but the common people wouldn't know to read these ways, and the Sofrim teach us that these are the proper ways to read the words.
Such as
Eretz versus Oretz, or Shamayim versus Shomim, or whatever. As a matter of fact, one explanation I didn't mention yesterday is that the three examples that the Gemara gave, Eretz, Shamayim, and Mitzrayim, all three of those words have this in common, that you find the same letters in certain places in Tanakh with other nekudot and an entirely different meaning. Eretz can also be Orut, Shamayim can also be Shomim, or Somim, rather, that they place. Mitzrayim can be Mitzorim. So Mikra Sofrim tells us the proper way of pronouncing it.
And that's the Moshe Mitzvah.
That's what we're saying is Halacha Moshe Mitzvah. Itur Sofrim, we said, is a very stylistic detail. And we said that there is Kaoyan V'Leksivan, certain words that are read as part of the text of Tanakh, even though they're not written in the Sefer Torah or in the scroll, and vice versa, Ksivan V'Lekaoyan, ones where it's the other way around. You have a word that's written but not pronounced. So now that's where we're up to, five lines from the bottom. What are some examples of Kaoyan V'Leksivan? For example, Pros de Belechta, each one, I mean, in the times of Gemara, they didn't have numbering of Prakim and Tzukim, so you can refer to something by saying Perek this, Pasuk that. So Gemara refers to each one using a key word in that Pasuk. For example, so there's a word Pros that's adjacent to the word Belechta. Belechta v'hashiv yadim v'nahav Pros is the Lashon HaPasuk, it's in Shmuel. So the word Pros is the name of the river, Hanor Rav Yehu Pros. So it's describing over there how David HaMelech fought against the king of Aram, the king Hadad Ezer, Belechta l'hashiv yadiv v'nahav Pros, when he was going to restore his power by the river Pros. The word Pros, if you have a scroll of Sefer Shmuel, it'll just say that Belechta l'hashiv yadiv v'nahav, and the next word is missing, and then you begin the next pasuk. So it's part of Torah Shabbat Peh, it's part of Halacha L'Moshe Mitzvah, that you have to add the word Pros there.
But
it's, even though it's not written in, right? Similarly, Ish to Kasha, Yishal Ish Vidbar HaLekim, another one. Each one was different Jerushas. Why? Each one, there's various Jerushas. There's actually a Medrash that brought Otsim Adroshim, also an Otsim Agonim, that explains for each one a reason. And then various Mepharshim also offer reasons. Some of them maybe as we will learn the list, and then we can talk about a couple of them. Ish to Kasha, Yishal Ish Vidbar HaLekim. Again, you have, in a handwritten Sefer Shmuel, it would say Kasha Yishal Vidbar HaLekim. The word Ish is missing. When you're reading the pasuk, you have to know to put in the word ish. Boyim de nivnasa, la de pleita, es de heg de hagid hugad, eli de hagoran, eli de hasaurim. Those last three are all from Ruth. Holein kaoyan v'leikosvan. All of those are words where you read the word even though it's missing in the actual written text. The Ran points out that actually at least one of the ones on the list over here, Es of Hagid Hugad, is actually not, we don't have an Armasura like that. First of all, the Pasuk doesn't even have the word Es, actually. But second of all, also, even if it's a different word from that Pasuk, there's no Armasura, doesn't have, the version of the Masura that we use in our Tanakh does not have any word that's read but not written over there. So either it's a Torah set forth in the Gemara, a mistake that the Gemara meant some other pasuk in Rus, and the copyist misread it, or just there's a possibility there are certain places, just like there's machlokas in about various other things in halacha, there's machlokas in different places about details in the Masorah. There's a number of places if you ever look in Minchas Shai, an important sefer on the Dikduk and the Masorah of Tanakh. You'll find in some places he points out that Ma Ravoi, the Westerners, meaning Bnei Eretz Yisrael, had one version of the Masorah, and Madin Choi, the Easterners, meaning Bnei Bravo, had a different one. Usually we follow the Ma Ravoi, the Westerners, Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara is written in Bavel, so therefore it tends to follow the Madin Choi tradition. So therefore some of the details that the Gemara is mentioning over here may not exactly match how we find it in our Tanakh. And for that matter also, the Ran points out there's a couple of other examples that are missing in the list in the Gemara over here. And in fact, Hagoyes Agra adds them all. He wants to say that actually they should all be in the Gemara over here, but not necessarily. Maral says, for example, which is Maral's long discussion of this Gemara in his Sefer Tiferes Yisrael, he says the Gemara is not trying to give an exhaustive list, just giving a representative sample. Okay, so what's the meaning of why some of these are missing? Again, each one has its own thing. The Kasha Yishal Ish Bidvar HaLakim, for example, is talking about Achitofel, that asking advice from him was like asking advice from the Eibishter. That's how reliable his advice was. So the word Ish is left out because who would usually be asking his advice up to that point? David. There's an idea. David, in a way, is not an Ish. David is beyond an Ish. He's more like a Malach. Therefore, the word Ish is read, but it's not written to symbolize that idea. The Elies from Megillas Ruth is twice over there. That when Ruth is talking to Naomi, one time when she says everything Kol Asher Temri Eli, everything that you tell me, I will do. When Ruth tells her to go, when Naomi tells her to go to the granary over there and meet Boaz in the middle of the night, and later on Ki Amar Eli, he told me. So there's an idea. Doesn't so to say the word Eli because like it's showing her bittul, like there's not even a to me. It's like, you know, whatever you say and he said, like as if I'm not even like as if like my ego is not even in the picture. And similarly with each one of them, there's an idea, there's a drasha behind it. The cast from the Lekaya, and then you have the other way around, words that are written in the text, in the written text of Tanakh, but not read. They are Nadi Yislach, and they're in the story of Naaman over there after he was healed from Tzaraas, where he tells Elisha that from now on I'll only worship the Eibishter, but I'll become a Ger Toshav, but when I have to accompany the king of Aram to go to his local temple of Avodah Zarah, he bows down there, and I'm going to have to bow down with him as well. The Eibishter should forgive me. Yislach Hashem. Avdecha, so it says over there, no. There's a no written over there, but we don't read it. When we say that pasuk is part of that Torah, Parshas Tzaraas, we don't say the word no.
How can the Eibishter forgive him?
Because he's a Ben Noach. He's a Ger Toshav, and a Ger Toshav is not Mitzvah and Kiddush Hashem. The Gemara discusses in Sanhedrin.
Naaman.
He became a Ger Toshav. He didn't become a Ger Tzedek.
In which
sefer? It's in Sefer Melachim. The one that's in the stories of the Nitzim that Elisha did.
So a Ger Toshav
is not obligated in
a Ger Tzedek.
He's a full-fledged Jew. Yeah. Okay, but he was a Ger Toshav. Okay, another one, Zois Da Mitzvah, and this one is a little controversial also, which one it means. The Ran says it refers to a pasuk in Parshas Vaschanan, but again, we don't have it in our Sefer Torah that way. As a matter of fact, there's none of these examples anywhere. All these examples are from Nach, none of them are from Chumash. So there's different possibilities what it could be. There's one possibility is that instead of Zois, it's supposed to say Ve'es. And it's referring to a pasuk in Yumi, of Es HaMitzvah Ves HaChokim, where again it's one of those Maravoi Madin Choi things, where the Madin Choi had a tradition over there that there's a word there that's written in the pasuk but not read.
And we
don't have it. We have it both written and read. Yidrech the Hadorech, also from Yirmiyah, Chomesh to Pas Negev, towards the end of Yechezkel, Im de Ki Goyel, also from Ruth, Holen Kastan and Lekarian, all those are examples of words that are written but not read. And again, with each one of them, there's a Jerusha, different ideas behind it. The Na of Yislach, for example, there's the idea that, okay, you know, technically Naaman's correct. He's a Ger Toshav. He's not obligated to go on Mesiras Nefesh, to not pretend to worship Avodah Zarah. But still, you know, is it really a right thing? No. So like the Pasuk writes over there the word Na, but we don't pronounce it like to hint at that idea. Like it's not really just a great thing. And then similarly with the other ones. No, I mean, he's a Ger Toshav, but whatever.
Even Alachic is correct.
Okay, that's the point. In other words, yeah. Okay, Bechlal was the question. A number of Mephoshim asked, what do we mean? What do we mean when we say that this is Halacha L'Moshe Mesinai? If all these examples over here are from Nach, then in what sense are they Halacha L'Moshe Mesinai? So there's various answers. One of them being that, in fact, we know the famous thing, Kol Ma Shetalmid Vosik Osid L'Chadesh, that everything that a Talmud is...
If it's from Nach,
Halacha L'Moshe Mesinai means that it was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. So how are we including Pesukim from Yishai, from Yumiya and Yechezkel and Rus and whatever, which were written hundreds of years later? What?
Could be Moshe Mitzrayim also.
So that's one answer, is that everything was originally given to Moshe Rabbeinu in potential life, and then afterwards it's actually written out. So yeah, the Pesukim were actually given to Moshe at Har Sinai, just the Eibishter told the Nevi'im to write them down at a different time. That's one answer. Another answer is almost the opposite of that. Sometimes when the Gemara uses the word Halacha L'Moshe Mesinai, it doesn't literally mean Halacha L'Moshe Mesinai. It just means it's as unassailable, it's as it's unchangeable as if it were halacha Moshe Mitzinai. But really, it was each Navi, when he wrote down his sefer, did it with his own nevuah, with his own Ruach HaKodesh. And a third possibility is that sort of in between, as happens in Maharal takes this view, is that when the Eidishit gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, he told him, you know, there's going to be times when you have something which the Pnimius is supposed to be one way, but the Chitzonius, the way that people have to understand it, should be a different way. So therefore, there are going to be places where you're going to have that. We have Kriyuk Siv is also a part of that, where sometimes it talks about, whatever talks about this in the Geras Yom Tet, in the Geras HaKodesh, also that there's places where you have the deeper meaning of something from Alma Deiskafia, from the hidden world, comes down in a way that we can't read, and therefore you have it's like an unreadable word in the pasuk, and then instead you have a readable form of it, which is from Alma Deiskafia, the revealed world. So similarly with these kinds of things, you have something where like an entire word like that is comes from Alma Deiskafia, comes from the hidden world, and is not meant to be revealed in our world, and therefore it's not written in the text, or vice versa. And so therefore the idea would be that the Eibishter told Moshe there's going to be such things, and therefore when each Navi comes hundreds of years from now to write down his Sefer, he should know that there's going to be times when he has to implement that.
Everything is going to be real when Mashiach comes.
No, that's different. Well, yeah. Speaking of details in the Sefer, Amar of Achabahada, B'mar Rabba Paskin L'Hodin Pesukah L'Tlasa Pesukin, in the West, again, meaning in Eretz Yisrael, they divide the following Pesuk into three Pesukim. Pasuk says in Yisroel, "Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Hinei Anochi Bori Lacha Ba'av Ha'anan." The whole pasuk continues, "Ba'avu Yishma Amu Dabrihimach Vagam B'Chol Yaminu La'Olam Vayagid Moshe Es Divrei Amel Hashem." So in Bavel they read it as one long pasuk, which is how we have it. Also, you know, this is an example where we go according to Bnei Bavel, not Bnei Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael they split it into three pesukim. So this is another example of a detail of Masorah.
So we read it through.
We read it straight through. Why did Bnei Eretz Yisrael split into three pesukim? Marsha talks about in Kedushin, where the Gemara also mentions this, that the reason is because the middle of the pasuk Ba'avu Yishma Am is not really directly connected to the first part. Eibishter is saying, I'm going to appear in a cloud. It's not Ba'avu Yishma Am Adabri Yimach, in order that the people should hear. The people hearing has nothing to do directly with the Eibishter appearing in the cloud. Therefore, in Eretz Yisrael, they figured it's more sensible to divide it into separate pesukim. Another idea also Mephoshim talk about is in Eretz Yisrael, the famous thing that in Bavel, they used to read Torah and finish it once a year, as we do nowadays. In Eretz Yisrael, they split it into shorter parashiyas and finished it once every 3 or 3.5 years. So sometimes you'd have a very short parasha. You needed to break up a long pasuk into shorter pasukim. Pasuk have enough pasukim for each other. Okay. Earlier on Lamed Zayin, the Gemara mentioned the idea that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't charge the Jewish people to teach them Torah, and we learned from that we can't charge to teach Torah either, except for Tzchar Shimur or Tzchar Pesuk Taimim, as we discussed before. So now, kind of going back to that issue, Amar Abchama Ber Abchanina, Loi Heshir Moshe Elam Epsaltan Shaluchas. Moshe only became rich from the leftovers of the Luchas. How did he become rich? Not from charging people for teaching them Torah, but from the psalus of the luchos.
Why did he become rich?
We'll get to this soon. What's the importance of him being rich, we'll get. Shenema, psal luchos, shnei luchos avonim, kodeshonim. As it says, carve out for yourself two luchos of stone like the first one, which means the word psal luchos teaches us psaltan shalachal yehei. It means the psal, we darshan as psalus, the waste of them should be yours.
So we read it on
Tanias, yeah. But it's in Parshas Kisisa, yeah. So the idea then that the Eibishter is also hinting to him that the waste of it, what's left over after you carve out the luchos, should be for you. The Marsha talks a little bit about it, that it can't be, usually l'cha means that the Eibishter is telling you to make it out of your own possessions. For example, take some of your own silver and make it into trumpets, similar to the others. Here, where the luchos are made out of sapphire, you can't see Moshe has a block of sapphire, so therefore it has to mean that the waste belongs to him. And the Gemara also says, Amar Rav Yosi ben Chanina, L'nitna Torah elo l'Moshe u'l'Azareh. The Torah was actually only given to Moshe and to his descendants. Shenema k'sav l'cha, p'sav l'cha. The pasuk says, write for yourself the Torah. And it says, write the Asarot HaDibros, and more generally the Torah. And it says, carve out for yourself. Ma p'saltan shalach. So just like p'sav l'cha, we're learning that it means that the waste products of it, the leftover chips of sapphire, belong to him. Aksavan shalach. Also the writing of the Torah belongs only to you. However, Moshe Nag Batovas Ayin, Moshe was generous with it, Vinasna Yisrael, and he gave it to the Jewish people. On him, the Pasuk says initially that a person with good eyes, he should be blessed. So really, the Torah should have only belonged to Moshe. That's what he's talking about. The Pasuk says, the Eibishter commanded me at that time to teach you the Torah. So it's not just that it was given only to Moshe, it was like a filler meant for everybody. The answer is no. You can understand the Pasuk to mean, the Eibishter commanded me the Torah, and really it was meant only for me. And I went ahead and taught it to you. So in other words, we parse the pasuk. Va'osi tziva Hashem, va'itahi. The Eibishter commanded me the Torah at that time, and then on my own, l'lamed eschem, I decided it would be good to teach it to you. But what about
the pasuk?
No, the pasuk doesn't say va'ani. We're understanding. We can understand that it's two different things. Va'osi tziva Hashem and l'lamed eschem. It's not the Eibishter commanded me to teach you. It's the Eibishter commanded me the Torah, and I, on my own, taught it to you. What about another pasuk? Look, I'm commanding you chukum u'shvatim as Hashem commanded me. The answer is also you can understand the pasuk the same way. Same thing. Behold, I've taught you on my own initiative the chukum u'shvatim. And what did I teach you? Exactly what the Eibishter taught me. So really, it was only meant for me. Okay. What about the pasuk says, the Eibishter tells Moshe Rabbeinu, write for yourself this shira, this song, which means, more narrowly it means parshat Hazinu, more generally it means the whole Torah, but Rambam in fact explains
for the Jewish people.
Well, lachem meaning for the Jewish people, yeah. It's not only that. I mean, lachem in the pasuk can mean just Moshe and Yeshua, who the Eibishter is addressing in the second before that. But the pasuk continues, v'lam der kenei tzirah, teach it to the Jewish people, sima v'fiyam, place it in their mouth. Now, the shira, now that's the thing. What the Gemara is going to discuss over here is, the word shira can have two meanings. More narrowly, the shira just means hazinu, which is shortly after that in the Torah. But more generally, it means the Torah, and more generally, as Gemara is going to explain, it means the Torah in general. So there you see, Moshe is commanded to teach it to the Jewish people. Okay, so the answer is, the Gemara says, fine, you can say hashira l'choda. Fine, it just means that Moshe is told to teach them the shira, not necessarily the rest of the Torah. Okay, what about the man tia li ashira azos la'ed b'vnei Yisrael? Fine, what do you do with the pasuk continues? In order that this shira should be testimony for me against the Jewish people. Meaning, in other words, the shira itself, fine. I mean, the shira itself goes through in detail if the Jewish people listen to Hashem, then they'll have all the good, and if they don't listen to Hashem, then the opposite, chas v'shalom. But eventually, ki yavin Hashem amei d'day, b'shir will judge us and take us out of Golos. Good. But if you only have the shira by itself, how are you going to know what it means to obey the Eibishter? You need the whole rest of the Torah to teach you that. So you see that the Eibishter did was telling him to teach the whole Torah. So the more answers, you're right. Ela pilpula ba'alma. When we said to begin with that the Eibishter gave the Torah to Moshe and he on his own generously gave it to the Jewish people, we don't mean the Torah itself. What we mean is the pilpul of Torah, the deeper understanding, the charifus, the delving into it to be able to derive one thing from another. That's what he gave specifically to Moshe.
That he could have kept.
Also, the Rosh also talks about it, the idea that all the chachma of the Torah really is hinted at in the shapes of the letters of the Torah and the individual words of the Torah, the kriyot siv, that kind of thing.
How could we understand it?
Well, when you get down to it, I mean, according to Chassidus, you know, when Chassidus talks about all over the place, the Torah is chachmaseh, return of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Really, by any logical thing, no human being should be able to understand it at all. Even we're going to learn soon, right before the Mishnah, that even Moshe Rabbeinu himself kept on forgetting the Torah when he was taught it over until the Eibishter finally gave it to him as a gift. The idea is, what the Gemara is saying over here, one way of understanding what the Gemara is saying is that if it weren't for Moshe being generous, then yes, he would have taught us the Torah, but we would have just known, we would have just understood the surface meaning of it. Only Moshe and his descendants would have had the deeper understanding. Moshe was generous, and also some of the poetry say it also includes the Sodas HaTorah, the secrets of Kabbalah, all those kinds of things is what Moshe generously gave to us.
With the authorization of the Eibishter?
Well, I mean, obviously the Eibishter approved of it, but yeah, but it was Moshe's initiative, yeah. So one idea is also some of the poetry talk about that what the Gemara means here is like this. If it hadn't been for Moshe's generosity, what it would have been is, there's a couple of Mepharshim and Eniakim talk about this, what would have happened is, yes, of course Moshe had to teach us all the mitzvahs, there's no question about that. but we would have learned them only bal peh. We would have learned, we would not have really have learned the we would not really have learned the Torah Sheba Sam. We would just have been learning the Torah Sheba Peh from Moshe if he hadn't been generous and gave us the Torah Sheba Sam as well. So yes, we would have known we have to keep Shabbos and we have to keep Kashrus and we have to be honest in business and so forth, and we would have learned the details of those, but we wouldn't have learned the actual, we wouldn't have had an actual text to put it together with.
Could we have gone to Galus without a text?
We don't know, whatever it is. I mean, it's counterfactual history. Moshe was Tovayim, and it gave us that as well. But when we say over here the Moshe or the Zaroi, the idea would be that who would have been the keepers of the written text of the Torah would have been basically the Kohenim and the Levium. Moshe himself was a Levi, his descendants are the Levium, and his Shevet. So they would have been the keepers of the Torah Sheba Sav, and the rest of us, not even the Torah Sheba Sav, we would have known, like, you teach somebody the practical din. When the Gemara is saying over here, Papula Ba'alma, it means also, not just the Torah Sheba Sav, it means also, like, the deeper understanding of Torah Sheba Sav. We'd understand, for example, we'd be told that we have 39 Melachos of Shabbos. We wouldn't understand the underlying rationales and where we learn them from the Pesukim and all that sort of thing. That would have been reserved for the Kohen and Levim. We find, by the way, Rashi mentions in Parashas Vayelech that when Moshe wrote the Torah, it says that Moshe gave it only to Bnei Levi, and the rest of the Jewish people complained. How are you talking? What are you making your Shevet the only ones in charge of the Torah? And Moshe said, I'm very happy to hear that. I'm glad to hear that you guys really want the Torah. So that kind of fits with our Gemara over here, that Moshe generously gave it to the Jewish people because he thought they tacka want it. Omer of Yechanan. The Ebishta only makes his Shechina rest only on somebody who is strong and rich and wise and humble. Yeah, exactly. That's the connection between this and the previous Gemara. The Kulon mi Moshe, and all of these we learn from Moshe Rabbeinu. Gibber, how do we know Moshe was strong? He spread out the tent, meaning the covering, the curtains over there on top of the Mishkan. Yeah. And we learn in a Braisa, or actually in Shabbos it says that Rav said it, Moshe Rabbeinu Parse, that Moshe is the one who spread it out himself. And now it says in the Pasuk, it says that the Kroshim were 10 Amos tall. So in order, now the Pasuk never mentions in all of the equipment for the Mishkan, it never mentions ladders. So the implication is Moshe himself had to be 10 amos tall in order to be able to reach up and put up the curtains. So you see, a 10 amos tall person is going to be strong. That's 15 feet. Question is, if you want to ask, so Emor de'orach b'katan. Fine, okay, so let's say Moshe is tall, but he could be weak. Katan, he could be like small in strength. Fine, you know, not every person who's tall is necessarily strong. So the Marshal talks about that. Fine, there is also, you have the Pasuk that says that Moshe put up the beams themselves, but fine. Rashi says over there on the Pasuk that actually Moshe didn't really put them up. It's by Yochim, like they put themselves up, so to speak. Like Moshe put in a little bit of effort and they stood themselves up. The beams. But fine, from that you don't have any proof of Moshe's strength. That's why the Gemara is trying to use as proof the fact that he was tall. The Pashto's height goes with strength. But the Gemara is saying, not necessarily. You can be tall, but skinny and weak, yeah? Yeah. So you don't have a proof from that. Okay. Ella min hodin kra. No, rather you can learn it from the following pasuk, Tachtiv. But etpois b'shnei alochos, Moshe Rabbeinu describes the events, what happened after the Chet Ha'egel in Parshas Eitzes. He says, I grabbed a hold of the two lochos, v'ashlichim me'al shtei yodai, I threw them down from my two hands, v'ashabrim, and I broke them. Vitanya, and we learn in a braise, haluchos orkan shisha, the luchos were six tfachim long, uverachman shisha, and six tfachim wide, v'avyon shloisha, and three tfachim thick. Yes, but they were made out of stone, they were made out of sapphire. As a matter of fact, the sapphire is pretty heavy stuff. Six by three. The Gemara mentioned, the Medrash mentions in various places, they weighed 40 saw, which is around 700 pounds. They were pretty heavy. They were pretty heavy. So what's the proof? Various explanations of how exactly we see the proof. One of them is that we see that the Shitim Kabbetis mentions that the pasuk doesn't just say that I, like, so to speak, like I dropped them, which may be okay, you know, they're heavy, so I dropped them. No, but I grabbed a hold of them, vashlichem, and I threw them down, which goes to show that he threw them down with force and they broke. So therefore, that shows the adjuvant's rule.
700 pounds.
Yes, there's also Shitama Kubetis brings the idea that it could mean the other way around. We could understand the pasuk to mean that usually we understand the scenario was he grabbed a hold of the luchos, threw them down, and they broke. But Shitama Kubetis brings the possibility, maybe the other way around. Maybe the pasuk means he broke them while he's holding them with his hand. That would show he's wrong, and then threw the fragments down.
Yeah.
That would show that he's wrong. Yeah.
Especially
if it's a diamond. Well, it's not diamond, it's a sapphire, yeah.
Sapphire.
Yeah.
Very strong.
Right. And that's Marshall says the other idea that he, when it said I grabbed them, means like I held on to them strongly in order to be able to throw them down forcefully. No, so that's the two different possibilities. Shitama Kubetis says he broke them while he was holding them. And Marshall says that no, he threw them and he broke them. The fact that he was able to grab them strongly and throw them down shows that he was strong. Yeah. Okay, so we see from that Moshe was strong. Oshu, where do we see that he was rich? We just said, Solachop Sultan, Shalachoyah, that he got the chips of sapphire that were left from carving out the second wolf.
Where did they get the sapphires from?
Ah, so the Medrash actually says that the Ebishah told Moshe, there's a sapphire mine under your tent. Start digging over there and you'll find a sapphire mine and you'll be able to find over there a block of sapphire.
Har Sinai?
By his tent, at the foot of Har Sinai. Yes. Incidentally, by the way, this is a Miriam Mephoshim asked the question. Okay, so we're saying that a Navi has to be rich. Mantoda is over a year after the Ebishah started regularly speaking to Moshe. He started, that was first when he sent him before Makkah's down. What about all that time Moshe wasn't rich, Lechora? So they give various answers, one of them being that maybe Moshe was rich before, but he donated all his money to Mishkan, whatever, different possibilities, but actually, one of the Gerer Rebbe, the Imre Emes, gives an interesting answer. He gives an answer based on the famous story of Rabbi Yitzchak of Yechel. You may have heard the story before. This was a Yid from Krakow who had kept on having a dream that under the bridge leading to the royal palace in Prague, there's a huge treasure buried. So, after a while, he keeps on having a dream. Finally, you know what, I may as well go and... Rabbi Yitzchak of Yechel, because his name was Yitzchak and his father's name was Yechel. Anyway, so he finally sets out for Prague, he goes over there, he's trying to, the bridge is very heavily guarded, he's trying to screw up his courage to do something, Finally, he approaches one of the guards and tells him the whole story, and the guard tells him, you came all the way from Krakow to Prague just because of a dream? You should know something. I'm having a dream every night that under the fireplace of a Jew named Yitzchak Yechel in Krakow, there's a treasure. You think I'm going to leave my post over here and go travel to Krakow just because of a dream? So he got the hint, went back home, dug under his fireplace, and there's the treasure. The nimshal was that Rav Simcha Bonim Shischa used to tell this story over to illustrate the idea that if you're coming to a Rebbe to help you with the Avodas Hashem, you should know it's really inside you. So similarly, this idea that Imre Emes says, same idea over here. If Moshe had this sapphire mine under his tent the whole time, then he is rich already without knowing it.
Without knowing it. They found something. Did you read the story in Yerushalayim? What happened?
No.
Someone's house in Yerushalayim. They found just kind of visiting that for 30 years. They found a mikveh that's taken from the
second bit mitzvah. Okay. Anyway, let's get back to the Gemara. Okay. Chacham. Where do we see that Moshe Rabbeinu was specifically a chacham? Rabbi Shmuel Dami Tavaya. We find that Rabbi and Shmuel both say he wasn't just a chacham. He was the ultimate chacham. Chamishim Sharei Bina Nivru Ba'olam. No, more than Shlomo. Chamishim Sharei Bina Nivru Ba'olam. There were 50 gates of understanding created in the world. V'chulam Nitnu L'Moshe Chaser Achas. All of them were given to Moshe, minus one. So he had 49 of them. Dichtiv, Shenema, it says in the passage, V'chaseru Ma'at Melekim. You made mankind a little bit less than the Eibishter. So like only the Eibishter can reach all 50, Moshe Rabbeinu reached 49 of them. Marsha explains, based on a Gemara elsewhere in Eruvin, that mentions that Rav Meir was able to understand the Torah in 48 different ways. The Moshe, who was greater than anybody else, reached 49. But to reach 50, that's reserved only for the Eibishter.
How can we limit the Eibishter with 50 levels?
No, we're not limiting the Eibishter. We're saying that there are 50 levels. And actually, in Chassidus, it talks about the idea that right before Moshe passed away, he was closer to that 50th level also.
Of
Chochma. And that's hinted at the idea, the name of the mountain where Moshe passed away is how Nivoy is Nun Boy. There are 50 in him. That's brought from Kitzvei Arizal, whatever, yeah. So therefore we see that Moshe was Chacham. Onav, and how do we know Moshe was humble? The Sivoy, Moshe Onav Moy. It says that Moshe was very humble. So there's a lot of discussion about this. First
more
of all,
than
yeah, that's the implication. Yeah. There's a lot of discussion about this. First of all, the Rambam said the Rambam discusses in Shemona Pratim when he talks about the prerequisites of a Navi, he explains the Gibur and the Osher over here not necessarily as meaning physical strength and physical wealth, but rather Gibur and Osher in the sense of Kaviyavet. Ezo Gibur Hakayvish Etzitzur and Ezo Osher Asameach. The Ran, Drashus, argues on that based on our Gemara. The fact is, I mean, the surface meaning of our Gemara, at least, is that Moshe was physically strong to be able to break the Luchos, and physically rich, and materially rich from the Psodos of the Luchos. So why Taka, the Ran goes on to say there, it is Drashus, so why is it important that Mela, they have to be a Chacham and an honor, if we can understand what's the importance of him being an Osher and a giver. One idea is that way people will look up to him more. People tend to look up to people who are strong and people who are rich. So like this, people will look up to him more and listen to what he has to say. And therefore it's important that a Navi should have these. There's also the idea, they talk about the idea that only when a person is a chacham and a giver and an usher, and then on top of that they're an anav, that's real anivus. There's also a bit of discussion, by the way, about, we're saying over here, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mashmeh Shechinasei. What about Bilam from this week's parasha? He certainly wasn't an anav. Okay, so that's an exception. They just did that only for the good of the Jewish people, and so that the goy wouldn't have a complaint that if we had Nevi'im, like Rashi says in the parasha, etc. What about, they say also, what about the fact that the whole Jewish Israel. People experienced Nevi'im? What? You certainly don't find that in Nevi'im. But did we find the whole Jewish people? Not that I know of, but to be fine, the whole Jewish people had Ruach HaKodesh at certain times at Kriyas Yamsuf, Rosh HaShivcha Alayam, at Matan Torah. So the Rosh forestalled that by saying B'tvius, that when we're saying over here, the Eibishter said that the Eibishter doesn't make his Shechina rest on a person unless he has these qualities, he means as a regular thing, not just as a one-time thing like the Jewish people. But a different answer that one of the Farshim and Ein Yaakov gives a different answer, that when the Gemara says over here, V'kulam mi-Moshe, we understand the simple meaning of it is we derive all of these necessities from what happened with Moshe. Since Moshe was strong and rich and so forth, then we learn that those are the prerequisites for a Navi. Another way of understanding the words, though, is V'kulam mi-Moshe, all of them, all the Jewish people, how did they receive their temporary Ruach HaKodesh? By reflection, mi-Moshe. Once Moshe was able to receive Nevuah, then he was able to reflect it to the rest of the Jewish people on a temporary basis. Amar Rav Yechanan, kol haNevi'im ashirim hayu. Actually, all the Nevi'im were rich. Minalon miMoshe miShmuel miAmos miYonah. We see this from four different Nevi'im: Moshe, Shmuel, Amos, and Yonah. That we see from various sukkim that all of them were rich. And another reason, by the way, why rich and why the Gemara specifically is focusing on that mile over here, is a person who's rich doesn't have to depend on other people. Therefore, it means he can be more impartial and not have to, it means he won't have to be afraid of telling the truth because generous is another matter. That has nothing to do directly with being a Navi, but the point is, like this, he can be more independent and be able to speak what the Eibishter tells him without having to be afraid of that they'll boycott him economically or whatever and ruin him.
No, for Moshe, I don't understand what's good for the Elchot.
We said the Psalms of Elchot. We're going to look in the other three. Right. Moshe, Dechtiv, Moshe. How do we know that Moshe was rich? Besides what we said before about the Psalms of Elchot, we have another thing. Dechtiv, Lo Chamor, Echad Mehem Nasati. In the story of Korach, Moshe says to the Eibishter, you should know, I didn't even take from them one donkey. So you have to ask, what does that mean? Ibaloi Agra. What does it mean? He's priding himself on, I didn't take any donkeys from them without paying. What, La Pokemon Shokaboloi Agra? What does Moshe have to defend himself? Like, I wouldn't take anything without paying. I mean, even a Kal Shabakalim wouldn't do that. El Adapti Laba Agra. So okay, you're going to say it means that Moshe's saying I didn't even rent a donkey from anybody, even with paying. Okay, you could argue that means he's rich, like therefore he has donkeys of his own, he doesn't have to go renting from other people. Fine, you could argue the other way around. Maybe he was so poor that he couldn't afford it, or he didn't have anything that needs to be carried on a donkey. We're trying to prove that he's rich. How can we prove from that pasuk that he was rich? So we can't. Element solachop sultan yeheshalach. No, you're right, we have to go back to the idea about the psalus of the lochus. You're right, you can't prove it from the matter of the donkey. Shmuel, where do we see that Shmuel was rich? Just did, because the pasuk says Hineni Anubi Neged Hashem and Neged Mashiach. Towards the end of his life, after he appointed Shaul as king, Haftarah Parshas Korach, he called the Jewish people together and he says, "I want you to testify on me in front of Hashem and in front of his Mashiach, in front of Shaul. As show me lakachti v'chamor me lakachti. Did I ever take anyone's ox or did I ever take anyone's donkey?" So again, let's analyze the pasuk. What does he mean? I never took them for nothing. I never took away anybody's donkey. I never acted as a ruler and took away anybody's donkey for my service. What? Again, does Shmuel need to defend himself against that kind of behavior? Of course not. So you're going to argue that Shmuel means that I didn't even rent a donkey, that I didn't even rent a donkey. Again, you could argue Dilma Dani Hava. Maybe the reason is
because
he was poor, and he couldn't afford it, or he didn't have anything that needed to be carried on a donkey, whatever, yeah. Ela mechacha. So no, we can't prove it from that pasuk, but we can prove it from a different pasuk. The pasuk describes how Shmuel used to travel around Eretz Yisrael to judge the people and teach. And the pasuk says, Ustruvasa haramasa, he would return to Ramah, kisham they said, because that's where his house was. Now, if the pasuk just means that he lived in Ramah, there's no reason to say it.
Where's Ramah?
Ramah is in the Nachla Binyamin, a little bit north of Yerushalayim.
That's where he is in Kever?
It's pretty close. It's either close or identical to the Kibbutz Shmuel. It's in that area in Ramah, in northern Jerusalem. Yeah.
Ramah?
Well, Ramah is the name of it in the Pesukim. I think nowadays it's more or less the area of Ramah. It's in Greater Jerusalem nowadays. Shuafat, that area, whatever. Yeah. Okay. If the pasuk just meant that Shmuel used to return home after his circuits, first of all, doesn't really need to mention that. Second of all, then the pasuk is phrased oddly. Instead of Ushuvase Haramasa Kisham Besai, Masha says, the pasuk should have just said, Ushuvase La Besai La Rama. What Kisham Besai? Because there is his house, like as if he has no other reason to go to Rama otherwise. So Rabbah says, it means Kol Makom Shaholach Besai Imai. It means wherever Shmuel traveled, his house went with him. Like, sort of like he had a mobile home with him, so to speak. Instead of relying on people to put him up and then give him food and whatever, he would bring along everything that he needed with him wherever he went in order not to need anything from people. So yes, we see from that he was rich. Arshad, by the way, points out another detail in this Kisham Besai. When you get down to it, where did Shmuel live his whole life? When he was 2 years old, Hannah brought him to the Mishkan in Shiloh, and he grew up over there. He never really lived in Ramah except for the first 2 years when his mother was nursing him. So you can't say Shavata Ramah Kisham Beisei because he lived there in Ramah. He didn't really live there in Ramah. He lived in Shiloh. So Kisham Beisei must mean this idea that wherever he went, he took along his house with him.
So how can we come as rich?
From there you see that he was rich. That he was able to carry along his household. How he became rich doesn't matter. They say, by the way, a Musa Jikavort on that, Kol Makom Shaholach Beisei Imai, we learn from this, when a person goes on vacation, make sure you don't compromise your standards of Yiddishkeit. Wherever you go, you should always make sure that the standards of your house come along with it.
Who says that?
That's a vort. It's a Musa Jikavort. I don't remember who said it, yeah. Actually, what it says about Shmuel is even greater than what it says about Moshe. By Moshe Rabbeinu, he says, I didn't take one donkey from them, which implies that even with rental. But what could that imply? In other words, that I wouldn't go over and ask somebody to rent their donkey, but if they were willing to offer it, then maybe I'd take it. The Ilugabi Shmuel, I feel a bit rotten myself, right? Whereas by Shmuel, even if a person was willing, he wouldn't rent it. Because even if the person says he's willing, he might just be doing it out of embarrassment or whatever. And so Shmuel didn't want to even take advantage of such a thing. The pasuk continues, when Shmuel gave that challenge to the people, tell me, did I ever take anybody's ox or donkey or whatever? They answered, by Yemru, Lo yashaktonu v'lo ratzei tzonu v'gomer. You didn't wrong us and you didn't ratzei tzonu. So the simple meaning of ratzei tzonu is you didn't break us. But the Gemara is doubting ratzei tzonu v'lo shen ratzei. That You didn't even take anything from us, even if we consented.
With our rotten.
With our rotten. Whereas that Moshe doesn't say that. Okay, so there we see that Shmuel was rich. Almost, where do we see that almost was rich? Vayan almost vayemer l'amatzia. Amatzia was the kohen of one of the temples that Yerovam had set up for the Egel Azav in Beis El. So when almost is saying Nebuah over there, the Jewish people are going to be punished. That the ten shvatim are going to be punished and sent into Golos for worshiping these Egel Azav. This Amatzia turns to almost and he says, you know what? What are you coming around saying Nebuah because you think you're going to get a few dollars for it? Don't bother over here. Nobody's interested in what you say. Go to Eretz Yehuda. You can say all the Nebuah you want over there, and they'll pay you a few bucks over there. So Amos answers, "Vayan Amos vayemer l'Amatzia, lo navi anochi v'lo ben navi anochi. I'm not a navi. I'm not a son of a navi. Ki boiker anochi uvoilus shiknim. I am a cattle herder, and it's somebody who takes care of sycamore trees. Sycamores are boiker means in Russian bucker, somebody who has cattle. Uvoilus shiknim and somebody who takes care of sycamore trees, which are a type of fig." And Knibatagrim of Yosef, and you shouldn't think that this means that Almos is saying I'm poor, like I have to herd somebody else's cattle and take care of other people's trees for a living. No. Rabbi Yosef teaches the pasuk, it's actually Tavim Yonason, are a more geise ana, I own cattle of my own, v'shikmin li v'shvelt of a gomer, and I have shikma trees in the lowlands.
Shikma trees
in
what?
Sycamore, it's called in English. Sycamore. It's a type of thing. The point is, he's saying, Tamatia, don't think I'm poor and I'm only saying Nebuah because I want to earn a few dollars. No, I'm independently wealthy. The reason I'm saying these Nebuahs is because Abish just sent me. So you see that he was rich. And Yonah, where do we see that Yonah was rich? In Sefer Yonah over there, in Matthew Yonah, it describes over there how he's running away after the Ebershah told him to go to Nineveh and give the Nebuah. It says he went to Yafo and he found a ship bound for Tarshish over there. He gave its pay and he went down into the ship. Now, if it just meant that he's paying his fare, then there's no reason for the pasuk to mention it. So therefore, it means he paid the fare for the entire ship. And the reason is, Maharshal says he wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. So like this, the ship's captain would say, you know, let's wait around, you know, people are going to be coming, you know. No, I want us to get going right away. Yeah. Also the Medrash says, also the Pasuk says, Ba'al Tarshish, that the ship had just come back from Tarshish. Usually they would take some time staying. Different opinions where it is. One popular opinion is that it's in Spain. Whatever it is, someplace far away from Eretz Yisrael. So whatever, if the ship just came from Tarshish, you know, they should be staying a couple of weeks in port, retrofitting, you know, whatever. No. So like this, no, I'll give you everything, just let's, yeah. And how much is that? Amar of Romanus, Schara Shosfina, have a dalit Allah from Dinre Java. The cost for booking that ship was 4,000 gold dinars. 4,000. So you see that Yonah was rich. And therefore, so we have these examples of these four Nevi'im who were rich, and we can generalize from that to the other.
How did he become rich?
For our purposes, that doesn't really matter, you know. Yeah. Going back to Moshe Rabbeinu, v'amar Rav Yechanan, v'tchilo haya Moshe loymed Torah u'mashachcha. Originally, during the 40 days on Har Sinai, Moshe kept on learning the Torah and forgetting it. Ad shenitna loy b'matana, until the Eibishter gave it to him as a gift. Shenema v'yitena Moshe k'chaloytza l'dabu ito. It says he gave to Moshe as he finished speaking with him. Meaning with so one idea of it again is it talks about in various places in the Siddur, the idea that again since Torah is Chochmasa, the Torah is Shalach Kadosh Baruch Hu, there's no logical way that a human being should ever be able to learn it, and especially I mean we're talking about learning the entire Torah, including everything that will ever be developed, the Kol Ma Shetam and Vatikas Kadosh. It's impossible to do that in 40 days. They just have to give it to him as a matzah. So what's the idea then? Why do they have to keep on forgetting it? One idea is the Yerushalmi says that a person should learn from this, that even if he learns and forgets, don't get discouraged. You see that Moshe Rabbeinu went through the same thing. Keep on trying, and like that famous story with Rupreda. Yeah, but still, keep on trying, like that famous story with Rupreda and the students who had to learn 400 times, and eventually you'll get it.
400 times?
That's a story.
We have to learn.
Well, not necessarily. It depends how much a person needs to, but whatever the point is. Yeah. Okay, no, come on. No, come on. That particular Talmud needed to learn something 400 times in order to remember it. No, come on. Okay. Continuing, the Mishnah says, continuing on this topic of somebody who's mudu hanam mechaveroi, what can he do for him? The Zonas Ishtavesbonov, she's allowed to support the guy's wife and children. Even though the Mudr Hanah is having Hanah from that, and after all, he's Chayev to support them. Nevertheless, this other person is able to support them. So one way of looking at it, now we learned at the beginning of the Perek, we talked...
He's Mudr.
That's the point. He's Mudr Hanah, but nevertheless, so what's the underlying idea? So the Ram says like this. We learned at the beginning of the Perek, a few days ago, that we had the Machlokas of Chanan and the Bnei Kohenim Golem about if somebody voluntarily supports a wife while her husband is away, do we consider that the husband has to reimburse him? Do we consider that he's acting on behalf of the husband? We said that Chanan says no, Ibn Isma Osev, and the Bnei Kohenim Golem said that no, he's entitled to reimbursement because effectively he's acting as a shliach. So one way of looking at it then, it Tosfos talks about, you could say that our Mishnah again is pointing to Chanan. And the reason why it's Mutter is because it's only Mavriya Hari. He's preventing this, he's not directly doing something for this person, he's just removing from him an obligation that he would have otherwise had to support his family. It's an indirect Hanah, though, according to Chanan. Or the other possibility Tosfos and also the Ram talk about is that since that it's sort of an indirect Hanah, because we're talking about over here it's a mitzvah to support them. So Tosfos talks about the idea that it can be sort of like you're giving it as a present, where then even the Bnei Kohenim Golem would agree you're not entitled to reimbursement. And the Ram talks about it that it's a matter of a mitzvah. So what kind of mitzvah? In the case of the wife, definitely, because you have an obligation to support them. In the case of the children, the Rosh discusses, are we talking about... No, the Mudr himself has the obligation. That's the point. This person is doing the mitzvah, basically. And the fact that the Mudr has Hanah from it is considered an indirect Hanah. The Rosh talks about also that which kind of children are we talking about. One possibility is we could be talking about regular children, because we learned back in Tzubas that the chiyu to support them is only midrabanan, the Mishnah really never talks about it. So one possibility, he says, Rabbeinu Tam says, we could be talking about a case that we had towards the end of Tzubas where a man marries a woman who's previously been married or has children from a previous marriage, and he makes a deal with her that he's going to support her children. So then he has that chiyuv to support them. So then if this third party is supporting them, then the argument is that that's okay. Again, it's either because of Mavriya Hari, or because he's doing it as a present, or because...
That's okay, meaning he's not obligated himself?
No, meaning that the Mudr Hanah, if he's not... the meaning that the person he's Mudr from is allowed to support this wife and children without it running afoul of the Mudr, of being Mudr Hanah.
Because it's indirect.
However, however, he's not allowed to give food to his animals, whether non-kosher or kosher animals, because then that's giving a real hanah. The animals now are worth more money. Rabbi Eliezer says, no, you're allowed to feed a tameh animal, but not a tameh animal. What's the logical reason for the difference? He says like this, a behemoth tahora, the soul of it maybe goes to Shemayim, but the goof of it belongs to him. He can eat it. So therefore, if this third party, the one who you moved it from, were to give food to this kosher animal, then you're having a direct hanah from it. Eventually, you're going to shech that animal. Reuven is mudr hanah from Shimon. If Shimon goes and feeds Reuven's cow, eventually Reuven is going to shef that cow and eat it, and he's going to have direct hanah from the fact that it's now fatter than it was before. Utmeya, nafsha the gufa l'shamayim, whereas utmeya, the body and the soul are both l'shamayim. In other words, you don't get anything out of it. You don't get anything out of it. Yeah, you could, but that's not on a direct hanah.
No, it's anybody. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what we're talking about. There's directly versus indirectly. Tosfos gives a different explanation. Nafsha v'gufa l'shamayim means that a behemoth tmeah, basically you only have hanah from it as long as it's alive. Once it's dead, there's nothing really you gain out of it. Whereas a behemoth tahora, when you shef it, that's when you get the hanah from it. That's what they answered. Omer loy afat tmeah nafsha l'shamayim v'gufa l'shamayim. Nu a behemoth tmeah also gets the gain from it being from it becoming bigger and fatter. Because if he wants, he'd be able to sell it to goyim or feed it to the dog. So therefore, he is getting a direct hanah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's why they have the machlokas. But that's why you have the machlokas. But we'll talk about it, and we'll talk about it in the Gemara a little further. But actually, the Ran points out that there may be a difference over here between: are you talking about giving the basic food that the animal needs, like to stay alive, or are you talking about extra food that's given to the animal to fatten it up? So the Ran says that the difference is that a tamidic animal, you don't use it for food, obviously, because it's a horse or a donkey or what have you. You're only using it for work. So adarabba, there's no gain for the owner of the animal when the animal being fattened up. Adarabba, if it's fattened up, it's not going to do work as well. So therefore, the Rana argues that Rabbi Eliezer would agree that you're not allowed to give, that you're not allowed to give the basic food to the animal, what's needed to keep it alive, but you'd be allowed to give, in the case of a behemoth meh, you'd be allowed to give food to fatten it up because you're not really giving hana to the owner. He's not going to be able to ever eat it anyway. And whereas the Chachamim point out that, yes, you yourself may not be gaining because the animal won't do as good work, but the fact is, when it's dead, you could always sell it to a guy for food, or when it's dead, you can sell the carcass to a guy for food, or you can use it for dog food or whatever, and then you are gaining from the extra flesh.
If the animal's alive and it's fattened, you're going to get more money if you sell it to goy.
That's what the Chachamim are answering. That's the argument of Chamar. And then the Ran points out. Then the Ran points out that the Rashba actually explains it the other way around. That the Rashba says that on the contrary, Rabbi Eliezer would say you can give the basic food for the animal to stay alive, but you can't give the amount to fatten it up. No. The Ran says I don't agree with that. Yeah.
Why?
Because he says that's not logical, the Ran is saying. As we're saying, the owner presumably has more hana from you keeping the animal alive and not overfed versus overfeeding it. The Gemara says, "Hamudu hana mechaveira." If one person has a neder not to have hana from his friend, mutu lahafti lebita. He's allowed to marry off his daughter to him. Question is, Havi bar Rav Zera? So Rav Zera wondered about that. The Maya Skinnan, well, what kind of case are you talking about? Ilema b'shenichse avi kala aser, who's mudder from who? Ilema b'shenichse avi kala aser in al-chosin, is it that the chosin is also to have hana from the nechosin of the father of the kala? Then why should he be allowed to marry his daughter off? Harei mosel l'shivcha l'shamshay. He's giving him, effectively, a shivcha, to a maidservant, to take care of him. That would be you having hana from him. I mean, a wife has certain obligations around the house, housework and whatever, to do for her husband, as we learn in Ksuvos. So that would be considered a direct hana. You're telling me the other way around then? Maybe that Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Hananya would be talking about the case the other way around, where the father-in-law is also to have hana from the nechassim of the chassim. Well, in that case, what's the chiddush that he's allowed to marry off his daughter to him? We have even more than that. We said in the Mishnah, Zonas Ishtev Es Bonav, that somebody who you mudu hana from is allowed to give food to your wife or your children, even though you're obligated to feed them. How much more so you're allowed to marry off your daughter to him? Once he marries her off, then he becomes potter from feeding her anymore. So if this chassan would have been allowed to give food to this daughter even before she's married to him, how much more so you can marry him off to her? There's no chiddush in that. The answer is la'olam b'shenichse avi kala asur in al-chassan. Okay, let's go back to the original case that the son-in-law is also to have ana from the father-in-law, but you were assuming that, and in that case, why should he be allowed to marry off his daughter to him? Wouldn't that be hana? The answer is, we're not talking about you assume to begin with that the daughter was a tana or a naira where the father has the right to be mekadesher. No, we're talking about she's a begeres. The father has no right to marry her off. It's on her own. Umidaita, it's on her own. Once it's on her own, you can't say that you're having hana from this person's nechassim, because she's not considered his nechassim anymore. She's a begeret. She's on her own. Or the Ran says another possibility. What the Gemara means is that midaita means as opposed to if the girl wants to marry the chassan on her own, as opposed to if the chassan goes to the father to ask him to read the shidduch, that would be having hana for him. But if the girl herself, midaita, on her own, goes, then the Rosh gives a third possibility that even if it is the father advising her to get married, since he can only advise her, he can't actually tell her to get married when she's a begetter, then it doesn't mean anything. It's not considered, yeah.
Because her own decision.
Yeah. Similarly, also somebody who's mudah hanah from his friend, that person is not allowed to marry his daughter. Okay, but he can marry off his daughter with a begeret, and with her own free will, again, either, because then it's a different threat, right?